Welcome to the podcast where heavy industrial industries meet the venture capital ecosystem, interviewing both thought-leading investors and pioneering founders to better understand the opportunities and challenges that lie ahead for digital industrial innovation. Your host is Ty Finley, and this is the Heavy Hitters Podcast.
Eric Spiegel joins us today from Sarasota, Florida. Eric is currently a special advisor at Brighton Park Capital, a growth equity fund where he helps identify software and tech-enabled services in industrial, energy, and healthcare markets. And before that, he was a special advisor to General Atlantic. Before jumping into the growth equity scene, he was the CEO of Siemens USA for 7 years, running the largest subsidiary of Siemens AG. And prior to Siemens, he served in key global leadership roles at Booz Allen Hamilton and Booz & Co. And aligned to his decades of experience in the energy and industrial markets, Eric is also the author of Game-Changing Options for Fueling the Future. His latest investments experience spans companies such as EN Engineering, Clear Result, Perishable Shipping Solutions, One Oncology, and Relation. Eric, I'm really excited to continue our Industry 4.0 conversations with the Covalent guys and bring it onto the show. So welcome to the Heavy Hitters.
Thanks, Ty. It's great to be on. I've listened to the podcast before, and you've had some great interview, so I hope I can keep it up.
I have no doubt. So as always, we like to kick it off with, I gave my little brief introduction about yourself, but give us much more color commentary on the path that led you to becoming the CEO of Siemens USA.
Yeah, I had spent 25 years at Booz Allen working across various energy and industrial markets, a lot in the U.S., but I also lived in Tokyo for 4 years where I ran Asia, the Middle East, and Australia, and really helped to grow the business there. So I got to understand what was going on in the industrial energy world over there. And then when I came back to the U.S. after that, we sold the government consulting business to Carlyle and spun out Booz & Co., which is the part of the business that competes with McKinsey, BCG, et cetera. And, I had done most of the senior leadership things. I'd run practices, I'd run regions, I'd worked all over the world. And I was in my early 50s and I said, hey, it's time to start returning phone calls from headhunters. And, one of the firms that was looking for a new U.S. CEO for Siemens contacted me and they said, hey, Siemens is looking for an American in this role. They want someone who knows the key markets like energy and industrial markets and healthcare, and also has some connections, knows a lot of senior people in the business world, and also knows the way around D.C. And of course, the headquarters for Booz Allen was in D.C. and I'd lived there for many years. What I didn't have was leadership experience in a large manufacturing company and a company that's also very complex and in many, many different businesses. But in the end, they were really looking for someone who could bring a lot of disparate businesses together and find synergies across them, drive organic growth, and really build the Siemens brand. Siemens hadn't spent a lot of time brand building in the U.S. And being one of the largest industrial companies in the world, they really wanted to have a much bigger presence. The U.S. was their biggest market, and they knew it was going to get much bigger. And they also wanted to have someone who could help to develop talent in the U.S., not just for the U.S. market, but for Siemens globally. At that time, there were very few Americans in senior roles around the world for Siemens. That's changed quite a bit now. And it was a great experience for me. Took quite a while to get acclimated to such a huge, global, complex company, but I learned a hell of a lot.
Yeah, well, we're going to come back to that global purview that you have a unique vantage point here in a second. I can't wait to dive in on that. But maybe just set the stage for our listeners first. Can you tell us a little bit more about your current role, Brighton Park Capital, generally, your role's responsibilities as a special advisor? And how does a special advisor fit into a firm strategy at great firms like Brighton Park and General Atlantic?
Yeah, so, when I retired from Siemens in 2017, I wanted to stay active, but I didn't want to work full time. I knew my background from being in consulting and then being in the operating role at Siemens lended itself to private equity. I had, of course, worked with a lot of private equity firms buying and selling companies at Siemens, and also in my consulting role, I'd done a lot of work for private equity firms. And I went around and talked to a lot of the firms, and I ran into a guy named Mark Jalga, who was the chief investment officer at General Atlantic at the time. And Mark and I hit it off. I came on, as an advisor there. And within a few months, I was chairing a couple of companies that we invested in, General Atlantic. That worked out really well. And then we started up a healthcare company called One Oncology. And about 2 years into that, Mark decided to go and start up his own firm, Brighton Park Capital. I thought that was pretty exciting. He had a real thesis around getting involved with companies earlier than the big companies like the General Atlantics, and doing so not just bringing capital, but bringing a lot of advice. And the idea was not so much operating partners, but senior advisors, people, C-level people who have a history of helping companies, making companies grow, and making companies be successful. So I was the first advisor. He asked me to come join and help to recruit some other advisors, help to identify potential investors, and work with, you know, with the partners of the firm to find good companies, both in the healthcare sector and in industrial sectors and energy. So that really attracted me to move over there. So I've been supporting Brighton Park for a little over two years now. I think an advisor role is quite interesting. There are different types of advisor roles, but in the role that I'm in, I kind of do a lot of things. I'm engaged on a weekly basis, helping to identify companies or introducing new companies. I often engage on the due diligence of companies that we're going to buy, interviewing a lot of the senior executives and thinking through the strategy and how we would grow the company. I sit in on the investment committee decisions. I'm not an investment committee member, but I sit in on all the companies we're looking at. And if I see something interesting, or if I see something where I have some ideas or some thoughts, I engage with the partners that are involved there. I sit on a couple boards. I chair the board of one of the first investments called Relation. And I also just help our companies in a variety of the portfolio companies get engaged with customers that I have relationships with, both in the U.S. and around the globe. So it's quite exciting. We have three types of advisors, that type of advisors that we have several of. But a lot of the advisors either just want to get engaged on specific topics and advise CEOs. Other ones want to sit on boards. And so there's a variety of roles. But I like being a little more involved with the firm. And in particular, I like working with these smaller startup companies and working with CEOs to help them think through how to grow the business. And that's where I can bring a lot of my experience to bear. So
yeah,
it's been a great time.
Very lucky to snag you, and it's a world-class shop. And a good buddy, Sam Cantor's over there working with you on multiple companies. So can't speak highly enough. And I'm going to drag you down to our early stage world of venture at some point, Eric. So just know that the ask is going to keep coming. But so let's dive in here. Okay, back to this global aperture. I mean, you truly do have a unique purview. So with all of that international experience, let's talk global to kick this off. Industry 4.0 may still have somewhat of a fresh buzzword within the industrial environment, but the race to modernize manufacturing capabilities has been in full swing for quite a while across the world, right? Whether Germany's self-proclaimed Industry 4.0 National Strategic Initiative, or China's Made in China 2025 National Strategic Plan, or the U.S.'s ongoing Manufacturing USA efforts that were kicked off under the Obama administration. And I think they now have 16 member institutes spread across the country driving innovation forward. So maybe let's start with having you first just define what is Industry 4.0 to you and the impact you think it will have on manufacturing. And then with that setup, where do you think the U.S. is relative to efforts in Germany and China? You know, what have we done well, and what has not gone to plan per se?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think there's a lot of explanations out there for what Industry 4.0 is, and there's a lot of things being added to it all the time. I think about it quite simply. If you think about it in terms of the first industrial revolution, the second industrial revolution, the third, and now this is the fourth industrial revolution, I think it's really about the interoperability of the manufacturing landscape through the entire value chain, right? Using sort of connecting digital physical systems. So whether it's the supply chain, the plant systems, service and the aftermarket, all of those things are now being connected. So there's that vertical connection. And then the second thing is we're really starting to connect the operating technology that's at the plant floor with the information technology that runs the business. So that IT, you often hear the term IT, OT, and there's a lot of devices that are going in to connect the IT and the OT. But very simply, in the third industrial revolution, you know, you really had electronics and IT automating various steps in the process, but these steps weren't connected. And basically now what you're seeing is they're being connected, and a lot of data and analytics are being brought to that to not only make decisions at the shop floor, but to make decisions at a higher level in the company. So that's kind of the way I think about it. And if you think about it that way, it's not really, a lot of the technology is very sophisticated, but the ideas aren't really too sophisticated. And I think we'll talk a little bit about how companies need to think that through in terms of where they get started with that. But that's how I see fourth revolution.
Gotcha. And so lining this up against some of these other countries that are moving down the same path, you know, technology buzzwords aside, how are we stacking up? What have we done good, and where do we have room to improve?
Well, I think, you know, Germany has always been a leader in manufacturing, and it's, of course, an export-driven country. I think the highest percentage of GDP from manufacturing exports of any country in the world. Maybe China might be getting close to that, but I think Germany's always had that leadership in manufacturing and technology, and just a huge amount of capability in that area. And they really got started with this Industry 4.0 6-8 years ago. And when I was at Siemens, it was all people talked about. I mean, every one of the 40-some businesses at Siemens was spending time thinking about how they play in the Industry 4.0 world, the fourth revolution. And it was all over the country, too. The Hannover Messe, which is the largest industrial fair, would highlight all the companies in Germany and around the world, what they were doing that related to Industry 4.0. So, you know, I think Germany's been kind of out in front of this thing. They have to be good at it because, you know, it's really a part of their DNA. It's a part of who the country is, being a leader in manufacturing and technology and exporting that around the world. So I think, you know, they've set up a platform. They've invested heavily with the government. They get good collaboration among companies and institutions like the Fraunhofer Institute, et cetera. So it's a big deal in Germany. Everyone plays. They find a way to make really good progress. And also their demographics mandate that they continue to push the edge of Industry 4.0 because, you know, their demographics, aging population, not a lot of a decline in population. So they're going to be automating and trying to make things more efficient as they go. And so that also fills that need. I think in the U.S., the manufacturing renaissance that was started under the Obama administration was somewhat based on the German model, institutes like Fraunhofer. I was involved in some of the discussions as the administration started to set some of those up. They also, at the time, interestingly, part of the idea was to use the energy resources that were growing dramatically at that time with fracking around the country. So use that natural gas asset that we have to help drive manufacturing growth and create jobs, not just in the manufacturing sector, but in the energy sector. I don't think that's where the U.S. is at this point, but that's where it was. That's where it was back then. But and, you know, the U.S. has about 16 of these institutes they set up. I think if you talk to people, you'll hear to varying degrees whether they've been successful or not. The one I know best is America Makes Institute for Additive Manufacturing in Youngstown, Ohio, which is my hometown, and I'm on the board of Youngstown State University. And so Youngstown State University is heavily involved with America Makes and things that they do around additive manufacturing and the university can do to support that. And that institute has attracted very strong public-private participation. I think they have close to 200 organizations, both public and private, involved. Under the Trump administration, it became more defense-focused, and now under the Biden administration, it's more energy-focused. And I think one of the big areas that I think is really interesting to a lot of people out there is this whole idea about reshoring. And that's one of the areas that America Makes is involved in. The idea is with 3D printing and additive manufacturing, we can really speed up this process of reshoring. We don't have to build the manufacturing of old. We can think of new ways to use additive and printing and other technologies to modernize manufacturing quickly and get it up and running faster. So I think that's a really interesting idea, and probably a lot of companies out there are supporting that and thinking about how they can help in that initiative. And then you know, I think one of the big examples I've seen there is the U.S. has lost a lot of capability because we offshored so much, particularly in areas like tooling and machining. But additive manufacturing is highly productive in those areas and can really help. So I think you're going to see some big transformations in manufacturing in some of those areas as we move forward. So I think in some areas, I think the institutes have worked. In other areas, I think they've kind of lagged. And I think when I talk to people in different institutes, Siemens was involved in several of the institutes. But in the past years, I've talked to several people in different institutes. And I think they would say the way we set it up was a little bit different than Germany and definitely different than China. Too many kind of disparate institutes and projects, not allowing more focus and driving the ability to scale and adopt things more quickly. It's been difficult to get companies to give money to some of these institutes. There's a cost. There's different levels at which you can participate. You know, in Germany, for example, I said the government bears a higher percentage of that cost. And then they should have put more thought into how do you manage the efforts across the institutes to get more value out of the dollars being spent and move forward faster. Some projects, need to engage several institutes, but that's difficult to organize. And also companies are involved across these different institutes. And so difficult to ask them to get involved in multiple places. So, you know, it's not really a platform like they have in Germany. It's, as I said, it's more like disparate institutes. And so if I were going to do it again, I would think about both how do we link these things more closely? And then how do we have some kind of capability at the top and across these things to figure out when we get a good idea or a great project, you know, how do we quickly engage companies, public, private sector to drive it forward and scale it and not spend so much time fundraising and putting together value propositions and stop, you know, projects from cannibalizing each other, et cetera. So, and I think the last thing is in Youngstown, you know, a big part of it is how do I engage the local community? How do I get the universities and the high schools and the institutes and everything, the other parts of the community behind it, the workforce, et cetera, and get them more engaged. Not just, it's a national initiative, but having the local buy-in is pretty important. And they're learning how to do that now, but didn't have, that wasn't part of the initial plan. So I think the U.S. is doing okay. I think China is kind of an interesting, the Made in China 2025, because that one I think is like a lot of their five-year plans. I think I spent quite a bit of time in China when they were developing China 2025. And, you know, they traditionally had this this idea of being the world's factory. That was mostly producing, you know, cheap, low-tech goods facilitated by their low-cost labor and a strong supply chain. But they now want to upgrade manufacturing, you know, into a real technology-intensive powerhouse. They've been really looking to reduce their reliance on foreign suppliers. That's going to become more important if you think about the geopolitics that we're sitting in now with the war in Ukraine and China's role in potentially supporting Russia, or at least not supporting NATO in the West. So we'll see where that relationship with foreign suppliers goes. And, you know, decades ago, they really started this program with many, many joint ventures. I think at one point, Siemens had close to 100 joint ventures with different Chinese companies. And they learned a lot off of those companies. And now they can largely produce many of these products on their own. But again, they're trying to now even step ahead of that and become a technology leader. So it's moving quickly, and the U.S. needs to get our act together. We're definitely not in the lead. We have some leading companies and some leading projects, but we're not a leader right now in Industry 4.0.
Well, I mean, just the masterclass in itself from all the ways you just approached it. And I would say, I think your first word about Industry 4.0 interconnectivity kind of nails the point about the U.S., right? We have a foundation there. It's a good foundation, but none of them are talking to each other, at least on whole, right? And I think you and I maybe years and years crossed paths at the Chicago Digital Manufacturing Institute. I think it was still called DMDI at the time.
Yes,
but it wasn't
yes.
talking to America Makes in your hometown. It wasn't talking to Pittsburgh with the robotics lab. So I really do believe like we've got a good foundation. We just need to put a spark plug underneath it, bring them all together and get that thing back off the ground, because it's too important not to, in my opinion. So Okay, so moving us forward, aligned to our previous chat, I wanted to talk about the challenges of selling into legacy industries like industrials. Our listeners are well aware of the infamous pilot purgatory challenges they might face when selling digital industrial innovation into larger enterprise accounts. But something we've not talked a lot about is how do you sell into that layer of customers in the industrial mid-market, or dare I even say small to medium SMB, to really set off those customer acquisition costs to lifetime value purists out there. Myself, I'm currently supporting various levels of success, trialing different product-led growth and bottoms-up low-touch sales efforts. But can you tell us about your experiences trying to sell efficiently into this long tail of mid to small industrial operators versus what it takes to sell into the large enterprise? You know, what tactics have you seen that did or didn't work well for this segment of the market, given the general challenges to adoption we see at play?
Yeah, there's no doubt that I think the enterprise customers, and particularly along certain industries like automotive and aerospace and pharma and things, have moved out much more quickly than the mid-market and definitely the smaller market. I think for the middle market and even the smaller customers, look, I've been out and talked to a lot of those companies. They all need that they need to get moving or they risk becoming extinct. But many are, you know, they're very conservative, kind of set in their ways. Usually just telling them the benefits, in my experience, is not enough. We always found it better to take them to a location where it's already happening and talk to others who are realizing the benefits and can talk about the challenges of implementing new technology and capturing those benefits going forward. It's easier to see it live and hear about it then to hear it as part of a sales pitch, I think. The other problem I see is that for a lot of the mid-market customers, they're typically very loyal to one OEM or one distributor. So breaking into these customers as a new company with new technology can be really, really difficult. That often leads to your point about, you know, let's try a pilot because they're so committed to the existing technology, and the existing providers may not have the capability of what some of these new startups have out there. And so that's difficult. I also think a lot of companies don't do a very good job of quantifying the benefits and bringing the whole story around the technology to life. Sometimes it's hard to understand how these technologies can lead to these benefits. So companies need to spend time thinking more comprehensively about the value of what they are selling. I find if you have a really good story around that and can show people how it actually works, I think it becomes much easier. For the enterprise customers, I think startups have a much bigger barrier. First, a lot of these customers are more sophisticated. They have some of their own in-house integration engineering. You know, they're looking for more than the basic implementation of simple robotics or PLCs or SCADA. They're looking for people these days with higher value services and products that, for example, link the IT and the OT, connect operating data into ERP systems, web design, cloud integration, you name it. I mean, the more these capabilities you can bring along with the products you have, the better chance you're going to have with larger enterprise customers. I think the other thing with larger customers, many of them have to tie these systems together with other systems and also train their staff. So if you're a startup selling a point solution that's going to do one thing, as opposed to being part of a platform, you know, that can be a major barrier with these companies. So, a lot of these companies are trying to eliminate legacy systems and all the apps that they have and get down to fewer solutions that can do more. So that's something for the smaller companies think about as you move up. Is there someone I can partner with, or how do I integrate with other platforms? The more I can integrate with them, the easier I make it to implement, the better off I'm going to be. So,
yeah, I think a couple of those comments were around, you know, startups have to understand that the maturity of the digital industrial journey, if I'll use that word, that these companies are going on, right? Whether they need to go see it first or trying to manage just getting their initial software systems of record up and running. So maybe to that segue a little bit, Let's flip the tables to those companies that are going down their digital transformation journeys and zoom out for a second. I often get asked, and I'm sure you do as well, the very simple question, these companies looking to go down a digital transformation journey, how do I get started, Eric? So help our listeners frame in how you would advise these companies to set off on that journey. Is it securing external talent? Is it doing an internal SWOT analysis? Is it touring other facilities, like you mentioned? What are those first few steps you'd advise them to get going? And equally, fold into that narrative this mission-critical component called the human element and why you have to bring the skilled labor into this discussion / initiatives from the very beginning.
Yeah, it's a great question and one that, you know, I've seen asked many, many times, particularly from this mid-sized market. So a couple things that I think have worked and that I usually incorporate into my discussions. One is that this industry 4.0 is a journey. It's not a destination. Technology keeps changing. So you'll probably never reach, the fourth industrial. You'll never reach 4.0 or 4.1 or 4.2 or whatever. But you got to think of it as a journey to get to move in that direction. And I think one part of that is that, you know, I see a lot of companies that in manufacturing, in smaller companies, they're just not as open to technology and the change that's required to accept technology. And there's a lot of reasons behind that. It could be, you know, their background. It could be the type of employees they have. It could be, you know, their experience in the past or whatever. But, you know, the fact of the matter is much of this is fairly simple. You know, pick an IoT solution, some simple devices that measure, for example, inputs and outputs, put some sensors on the equipment, a dashboard to give, you know, supervisors and management some feedback on the impact and go from there. And make sure you pick something that solves, you know, a known problem, right? I was out at a CNC facility, company that has about 30 CNC machines a few weeks ago, and there's a company out there putting a simple device on each of the workstations that clocks people in and out, measures the productivity of the machine and of the operator, and provides real-time feedback to the supervisor. And they said it's like a whole new world in the plant. Now that they have the understanding of that, they've been able to increase productivity of the machines. They've been able to figure out which workers need trained more on which machines. They don't have to have people punching time clocks, et cetera. So pretty basic little technology, but you know, they say the productivity gains and the savings and stuff have been amazing. So start with something simple, but I wouldn't call it a pilot. It's, you know, this is where we're headed. And so I think as you do this, you need to make sure you communicate clearly with the workforce what you're doing and why. They need to understand it, and then train the workers, the existing workers, so they get excited about this and they can improve their quality of work, blend and also understand how we have to blend people, process, and technology. And I found that companies that do a good job of communicating clearly the journey that we're going to take and what we're going to do for them, you know, the employees get excited by it because it's just going to upgrade their capability and give them more options going forward. And in today's world where we're having trouble finding a lot of shop floor workers and things, you know, being able to do some more automation and things like that is got a huge benefit. And I always say to people, finally, that remember, there's a lot more downside not doing anything, right, in the long run. So I think that's the best way to go about it. And I've seen a number of examples where, you know, people take these steps and lay out a roadmap that says we're going to do A, B, C, D, and E over the next couple of years. Here's the training. Here's the communication. Here's the companies we're going to work with. Those kind of plans work well. Okay, throw something in, let's pilot it and see if it works. You don't get enough attention within your own company, and you don't get enough attention from the supplier. So,
yeah, well, I hope our audience is really taking it to heart. You have to get going. I mean, heck, we may be on Industry 5.0 before too long or whatever the new buzzword is, but you just have to get going. And to your comment, I couldn't agree more. If you don't think we need to be upskilling and retraining the 21st century workforce with higher paying, more productive 21st century jobs, usually digitally oriented, you're not going to make it on the journey. I mean, I've seen everything from robotic automation deployments. You know, the power cord gets cut with a razor blade, right? This is not something that you can't bring the full organization along together. So I just really appreciate you pushing the agenda forward.
I think something that goes along with that, Ty, is not only do these companies need to step up, but the providers need to step up. And, you know, a lot of that is falling on the system integrators out there, particularly with these small and medium sized companies. A lot of the bigger enterprise customers, the OEMs, as I said before, we'll spend more time with. But and if you take a look at the system integrator market in this country today, it's, you know, it is large, but it's very, very fragmented. And most of these integrators are subscale, both in sectors like, you know, say food and beverage or pharma or energy or whatever. And they really are subscale in terms of their capability. So, you know, a lot of those companies are actually struggling as well. A lot of companies are struggling with how to find the right integrator to help them with some of these solutions, particularly as they become more sophisticated and the need for more integration and just getting time from your integrator. I've heard a number companies say recently that they're having trouble finding someone who will come out and work with them on this journey that we talked about before. So I think there's going to be some big change in that marketplace in the next few years.
I think it's such a great comment. We could go down a long conversation about SIs and integration capacity, because even in my portfolio, you just can't find it. So if you founders out there listening, you're going down this path, know the SIs are going to be a part of that journey, and you can't get capacity right now. So be planning and thinking how you you avoid that challenge, as Eric, you call out. It's spot on. It's definitely something to be thinking about right now. Cool. So Eric, maybe last question here. We always love to bring the podcast back to the people at the center of the universe here, the founders, and give them some advice. If they're thinking about raising capital or reaching out to you, let's give them some keys to success here, and maybe a common pitfall or challenge to avoid as they enter that discussion.
Yeah, I think what I've learned to look for, you know, probably a few important things. One is the product or service really create significant value? Is there a strong need and a connection to the marketplace? And has that been demonstrated? There's a lot of stuff coming up out there. I mean, everything's being digitized. Some of what you see is interesting, but I don't think it's going to really have a big impact. So I would say, you know, make sure that what you're working on is broad enough and impactful enough that it'll get real traction in the market. Second thing is the market pretty large and deep? Is it big enough that I don't have to spend days figuring out if it's a big enough market to worry about? And then, you know, what kind of IP do you have? Is it defensible? Or is the technology difficult to replicate? That's important, because you really want to create a moat around the business eventually. And so you need to start on that early. And then I would think, you know, do you have a very compelling CEO? And I always use the test, would I put this CEO in front of some of my investors as one way to think about, do we have the right CEO? And then you're looking at things in the numbers, like, is there a good growth profile? And, you know, high double digits. Do you have a great customer list? And is your sales force pretty efficient? And is your, you know, what does your cash burn look like relative to how fast you're growing? So those are some of the things that I look for when I take a look at a new company.
Right on. Well, let's wrap it up here with a section we like to call quick hitters, a little bit of rapid fire Q&A. So if you're ready, Eric, we'll jump in.
Okay.
All right. What is the number one thing you're looking for when evaluating one of those founders in this ecosystem?
Ooh, good question. There's probably a lot of things. I would say, you know, it's in some ways it's not much different than what I look for, even when I would be interviewing people for senior positions in a large company or consulting firm. I think it's leadership. You know, startups have lots of ups and downs. And you're gonna have highs and lows. You've got a lot of turnover. You have to often change your strategy, change your product, change your go to market. And so the ability to lead others through that type of environment, I think, is paramount. So I would just say leadership.
Absolutely. What is one resource, you know, a book, podcast, blog, whatever you'd recommend our audience to follow within this broader industrial ecosystem?
Other than yours, right?
Yeah. Or your book. So we can both plug each other. There we go. Appreciate it.
Yeah. I would say, you know, the first really good book I read on it came out maybe 5 or 6 years ago. It was called The Fourth Industrial Revolution by Klaus Schwab. Mm-hmm. And Klaus is a pretty famous guy. He's the founder, and he was the executive chair of the World Economic Forum for a long, long time. And he does a great job at kind of shaping the upcoming change. You know, the book's a few years old, but I just thought it was a great read.
Yeah, we've had Francisco over at the WEF Advanced Production Group come on. I think he referenced Klaus's book as well, staple in this ecosystem.
Yeah.
One person who should be on the podcast, Eric.
Wow, we've had some good people on. I'll throw out something that's a little bit controversial, but I would say Carlos Ghosn.
Okay. Tell us more.
And I worked with Carlos for several years when I was in Japan. At Booz Allen, we were heavily involved in the Nissan Revival Plan, his big turnaround when he came from Renault to Nissan, mm-hmm. and really, you know, turned that company around, became CEO, transformed the company globally. Then he also became CEO of Renault. And at the end of his time, he was also chairman of Mitsubishi Motors, and looking for ways to put those three, probably by far and away, the best general manager I ever worked for in my career. Just an amazing guy. And he had incredible foresight in terms of where the market going. You know, Nissan, they didn't come out with a Tesla, but they were one of the first companies to go big on electric. But he had real insights into where manufacturing was going to go globally. He thought a lot about how do we knit the supply chain together, et cetera. Just a brilliant guy, very quick thinker, spoke multiple languages. Could play in just about any type of environment. So I would say, and he's often listed as the second best CEO in history of the automotive industry, next to Henry Ford. So yeah. He's had a little controversy, with the last couple of years and in Japan and escaping and that kind of thing. But you know, I think if someone to get on to talk about this, he would be amazing.
Certainly a game changer in every way, for sure. And then finally, Eric, the best way for folks who want to reach out to you, what would be the right way?
I just say email. I'm pretty responsive. I try to get back to people in a day or so. And LinkedIn is good. I've got, you know, 500,000 people connected to me on LinkedIn. So
you win the war, Eric, for sure.
But I'm usually pretty good about getting back to people. Not everyone all the time. There's a lot of selling and marketing going on LinkedIn. I try to stay away from those. But mm-hmm. for people who are looking for advice or help or a connection, I'm usually pretty good about getting back to people on that. So.
Well, awesome. Appreciate you coming on, sharing your wisdom, what you've seen in the ecosystem. And I'm going to keep saying I'm going to drag you down to the early stage ecosystem at some point, Eric. But jokes aside, thanks for coming on and sharing the lessons learned.
Well, I look forward to it, Ty, and look forward to connecting with you again. And good luck to everyone out there on your digital journey.